Welcome to the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast. Ramadan Mubarak, everyone. It is the end of the month of Ramadan. We've been fasting all month.
We have.
Zara, like, lifted up her fingertips and say, like, wait a second. Wait, hold on. Yesterday, Zara was like, can I drink water during our show? And I was like, wait, you're going to flaunt your water in front of my face?
Flaunting my H2O. Flaunting my H2O. H2O.
So for clarification, I've been fasting. This is Taz, and Zara hasn't been fasting. It's been a tough month, I have to say.
It's just been a hard month. It's been a painful month. It's been a really difficult month. And I also ducked out of Ramadan. But we're going to talk more about this in our hot topics. And I also want to hear, Taz, you went to the Allied Media Conference.
I did. It was amazing. The Allied Media Conference happens every year in Detroit. It's a bunch of radical activist types that get together to talk about organizing and media. And I did a podcast panel with Nina Badarachia from the Almira Radio Hour. Our session was packed. We did a whole hour of training on what to do to start your own podcast. And there was so many great faces in there. There's a lot of new podcasts, so hopefully they're listening. We love supporting podcasts. We love people who want to start new podcasts. So if you're interested in a training, bring us out. We're always down to go to conferences and speak on those.
Me too. I go to conferences and I speak. I have smart things to say.
Yeah.
Invite me.
Yeah.
Speaking of smart things, you also gave a commencement speech.
I gave a commencement speech for UCLA Asian American Studies. It was the weekend of Allied Media Conference, so I like went to the conference and then had to leave early, and I was writing the speech on the plane, and I was like saying it out loud while I was on this plane, but it was like a late night flight and two people on both sides, and I was on the middle seat and both people on both sides were trying to sleep, and I was just like talking out loud the speech because I had to give it at 10 in the morning and I landed at midnight. So it was a wild weekend. And your New York Times piece, I don't think we've had a chance to talk about it because that came out, I think, before we went to Manzanar.
Yeah, it came out a while ago and we didn't get a chance to talk about it in the last episode. I wrote a piece called It's Not This Muslim Comedian's Job to Make You Like Me or something like that. It was a really good title and it was really smart stuff. And it was just about all this, like, we're just like you, we're just like you, we're just like you, relate, 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 relate kind of comedy that I keep seeing and keep being asked to do. And I don't think it helps, actually. I think it's going to get us all killed.
Yeah.
Nobody believes you when you say, we're just like you. That's weird. We are just like you because we're people.
I have things to say on this topic, in our hot topic, but we'll come to it in a little bit.
Juicy.
So Ramadan. We're in the month of Ramadan. For people who are just new to Muslims, this is the month of not fasting. In case you don't know.
I think that should be our subtitle from now on. For people who are just new to Muslims.
The question that I hate the most is when talking to anyone, they'll say, even water? I'm like, yeah, even water. I want to say, like, even sex and even drugs and even bad thought. But, like, I think, like, the water is, like, the one that gets them.
I just want to put out there that for some of us, Ramadan is not about a food fast.
Totally.
For some of us, Ramadan is just overeating.
It is overeating. I thought you were going to say something else. I thought you were going to be like, oh, Ramadan is a month of spirituality. It is a month of prayer. You're like, no, it's for lots of eating. What do you eat for Ramadan in your culture, in your people's culture?
Well, I'm going to share my Ramadan experience after yours. Like, I want to hear the rest of your Ramadan experience because I have a feeling that we're going to contrast a little bit.
My cravings this Ramadan have been halim, which is this like stew with beef and barley.
Oh yeah, we make halim.
Yeah.
It's my favorite.
It's so good. But it's also like incredibly fatty because there's like all this ghee in it. So you can't eat too much of it. It's so good. And then there's this like Bangladeshi market in my neighborhood, which sells halim for Ramadan. And I'll order it, but they up the spice content. So when I'm eating it, like I'll fast all day. No, I'll break my fast and I'll eat some of the halim, but I can't even put it in my mouth. And then the whole next day, my tummy's burning. And then I'm going to the bathroom a lot. And it's terrible. And it's this like stupid cycle of like not eating and then burning my tummy with halim and then not and then feeling nauseous. It was not good.
We stick a ham hock in our halim.
You do not.
It's not a ham hock, but it's like a giant leg of lamb.
Oh, really? You don't, like, chop it up into pieces?
No, my mom just, like, sticks the whole thing in there because the bone, too, is, like, part of the broth. And
oh, yeah. So good. She doesn't chop it. Oh, I want your mom's Helene.
And then the lamb is just dripping off the bone.
I love lamb. Mm. So what's your mom's specialty during Ramadan?
Well, we break fast with nobody in my family is fasting this time around. Everybody's sick with something. And we usually, when we are fasting, we break fast with first tea.
Oh, yeah. We don't break fast with tea. I heard you say this on something and I was like, oh, we don't do tea. We do water and dates.
Yeah. I was like, what? No tea.
No tea.
We start with Persian tea because the caffeine opens up your digestive system.
What?
Yeah. A little caffeine. And then it soothes you a little bit. And then you have a date. And my dad plays on tape some men with beautiful voices singing Quranic tunes.
Oh.
Yeah. And we have Nuno Panir. It's like classic Persian fare.
Wait, what is it?
See, you're not in Berkeley. If you're in Berkeley, you're like, oh yeah, the Nuno Panir at Acme Bread. Everybody eats it.
Yeah, I don't know.
So Nuno Panir is basically naan and panir. So bread.
Like a grilled cheese sandwich?
No.
Or is it like naan and then like slices of paneer on top of it?
What do you mean slices of paneer? You don't slice paneer.
Oh, like Punjabi style of paneer is like the blocks of paneer.
Yeah, like feta blocks.
Yeah.
It's like feta cheese. And then sometimes you mix it with labneh and it's really awesome. And lots of herbs. Like Persians eat handfuls of herbs. Tarragon, basil, marjoram. And you just herbs de Provence. You just you wrap it in lavash. And you make a little hand roll of feta and herbs.
Oh my gosh, it sounds so good. It's 11:30 a.m. right now. I feel like I've been fasting all day.
I'm full already.
Can you make this for me?
Definitely.
Yes.
You have so many Persian markets in L.A. Are you kidding?
Yes, we can go to Westwood.
To Herangelis.
Is that the food that your mom makes that you crave the most?
I haven't even gotten to the food my mom makes. That's just...
Are you serious?
That's the shit on the table. That's just that's just around, man. You look so hungry. Taz is salivating.
Talk about what your mom makes. Talk about one item.
Well, okay, here's the thing. I can't talk about one item because Persians do a six entree menu just for dinners always.
Every night?
Well, anytime you have people over, and for Ramadan it's every night because iftar is every night. So you just go to people's houses and there's just six entree. Oh, and then there's competitions, but they don't say that there's competitions. They just act coy and they're oh no, well I just had it in the fridge. And it's no. You woke up at 6 a.m. to make this. Then you go to the next house, they have seven. And the house after that is okay, well, we're going to have seven too. Plus, we're going to do four different types of desserts.
Oh my gosh.
And then you'll be oh my God, you shouldn't have done this. And they'll be oh, it was nothing. I didn't eat. So what's your iftar experience like?
It's me in my living room with a glass of water and a date and a bag of food from Taco Bell. It's very depressing.
It's very Harold and Kumar.
The market, the Deshi market, which because I live so close to Little Bangladesh, they have these iftar to-go boxes there. And so I'll go and I'll get the iftar to-go boxes. And it's basically just a bunch of fried shit. It's fried pakoras, fried eggplant, fried lentils, fried this. And then I'll eat it. And then I'll be in pain for the next 2 days. So much pain that I won't be able to fast. And I was this is not how this is supposed to work. So, yeah.
That still sounds hella good, though.
It's so good. I have to do it at least once a year. There's something really cool about living in a neighborhood where you can actually get iftar to-go boxes. Because it comes in those, pink donut boxes, you know? And it's just, full to the brim of stuff.
Oh, yeah. I keep seeing those on Instagram.
Yeah, and it's just kind of cute. I know that in most places in America, you don't get iftar to-go boxes. And I just kind of love that you can get an iftar to-go box of Bangladeshi food. So I had an iftar party this week. And for the iftar party, I drove to Big Al's in Maywood, California. And Big Al's has halal barbecue briskets and halal pizzas. I talk about this on the Sporkful podcast. If you go to Sporkful, listen to the podcast, we go and record our episode at Big Al's. And for the party, I went and got a Big Al's Supreme pizza with halal pepperoni and halal bacon and halal turkey ham. It was so good. I was so glad I got to at least do that for one iftar. This Ramadan has been a lot of creating own rituals and traditions, which has been kind of fun.
Oh, nice.
Because now I think I want to go to Big Al's at least once a Ramadan.
I want to go to Big Al's.
We'll go to Big Al's next time you're here.
And you've been doing poetry a day for Ramadan still?
Yeah, this is year 5. We have a group of 6 people doing it this year, and it's been good. So for people who want to follow along, you can check out our Medium site. So go to Medium, type in Poetry a Day, and it should pop up. And we have all of the poems listed every day. It's really beautiful to like go through the process of writing a poem a day, but also to do it in community with folks and just read how people are feeling. So after the Portland stabbing happened, there was a lot of poems about feelings around that. And it, I don't know, as someone who doesn't have a lot of in-person community, because I work from home, and when you're fasting, you can't really work at coffee shops. So I actually spend a lot of time alone this Ramadan. It was good to have the poetry group to connect with people.
Yeah, I missed that. But I saw your poem about Nabra's attack.
Yeah.
It really hit home.
Yeah, so I was really nervous going into Ramadan because I know that every Ramadan there's an escalation of attacks against Muslims and attacks by ISIS in Muslim countries targeting Muslims. And sure enough, that happened this Ramadan. Ramadan started with a stabbing in Portland on a train. And this guy went on a rant and started verbally attacking 2 young women of color. One was in hijab, and 3 white men came to their defense, and 2 of them got stabbed in that process. And then this past weekend, Nabra Hassanan was attacked. She was attacked with a group of friends who were leaving their mosque and going to McDonald's or IHOP, depending on what source you're reading. And when they were being attacked, the group of friends ran, and she was running too, but she tripped on her abaya, and the attacker caught her and beat her with a bat.
Baseball bat. He abducted her, beat her with a baseball bat to death.
He raped her.
He raped her, beat her to death with a baseball bat, and threw her body in a pond.
Yeah.
17.
17. And then there was also a few other incidences that were caught on video of girls being yelled at in grocery stores and ice cream stores. And I don't know. After Nabra's attack, oh my God, I was so broken. I've had like such an unproductive week. Like Ramadan's already unproductive when you're fasting because you just don't have energy. But then on top of that, I was just holding so much grief with this that I was just completely a wreck. I was a total wreck.
Yeah, I wasn't able to do anything else, especially that day. It came out on Father's Day. We were on the plane coming back as a family from Seattle. We went on a cabin trip for Father's Day, and I just had to keep it to myself because I knew if I mentioned it, my mom would like go on a rant, and I didn't want her going on a rant on the plane.
Yeah.
And it was so brutal. And then the response to it, where the police officer was saying, well, it just sounds like they were in a dispute. What?
They didn't say a dispute. They said road rage. And I was like, road rage doesn't count if only one car is in this road rage, right? Like if the other people are walking, that's not road rage. Like it doesn't make sense. You can't call it road rage if one person's in a car. Like that's stupid.
Well, and one of the cops actually that spoke to the press was saying that it sounds like it wasn't a hate crime because it was over a specific dispute.
Which is stupid.
A grown man with a 17-year-old?
Yeah, a 22-year-old man.
Is a dispute with a baseball bat? That's just over a dispute?
With a baseball bat, yeah. And the thing is, like, every hate crime out there is a dispute. Every attack on women is a dispute. Like, everything's a dispute. And it's stupid to not address it as a hate crime. They were leaving a mosque at 4 in the morning. Like, it was very clear that that was happening. The attacker was waiting in the parking lot for them to finish eating their food so that when they came out, he would be able to attack them. That's, like, premeditated. That's not just, like, happenstance ran into them. You know, like, everything about this is reflective of hate.
And on that exact same day, Charlena Lyles was shot for having called the cops to her home in the first place.
Yeah, she called the cops because she thought there was a burglar, I believe, and she was afraid. And so the cops came, but they shot her instead. That was so ridiculous. And then that was also the same week that the Philando Castile announcement came out that the policeman who shot Philando in the passenger seat of a car on Facebook Live, 4 shots, was acquitted. It was just so... There's so much blatant attacks happening that if you just replace people of color with a white person, that the framing of the conversation would be completely different.
Oh, absolutely. It's been such a difficult month, and every year it just gets worse. And I'm trying to remember, I have to like go all the way back into my childhood for months of Ramadan that were not so filled with violence.
Yeah, I do believe that a big part of us remembering this is that we didn't have social media before. Now we're like hyper connected in this way that we weren't before. Unfortunately, NetBros attack, the Portland stabbing, a lot of these attacks that you and I are hearing about aren't covered by mainstream media. We're only hearing about it because our friends are covering it and sharing it. But if you watch late night news, stuff like this isn't getting covered.
Oh, wow. Because I only get my news from internet. I don't have cable. And that's horrifying to hear because NetBros attack feels like such a, I don't know how to explain that it's like, it's almost like a pinnacle to me of like, it's gotten so bad that a 17-year-old can be beaten to death by the baseball bat and then get no coverage, be called a dispute, and everybody just kind of moves on from it. In this climate of hate specifically, that we can just look at hate crimes at all right now and not immediately evaluate them as such is terrifying to me because it just is even that much more of a statement of how ready people are to look the other way at violence at Muslims and people of color.
Yeah. But it also reflects the need to not use the mainstream media as our primary source of media, which is what most people of color don't do anymore. Like, none of us are watching CNN.
Now, my parents get their news from CNN. My family watches CNN. I guess now thinking about it, you're right. They didn't know about NetBros until I mentioned it to them when we got home.
The thing that hits me the most about all of this is that all of these attacks were on 17-year-old girls. Like, the things that I've been hearing in the news aren't this Muslim man was attacked by another Muslim man. Like, what I'm hearing is this older man is attacking a young girl, which you're not supposed to do, right? Like, I mean, you're not supposed to attack anyone, but just this concept that, like, men are using women on their attacks. And not just women, but, like, they're attacking young girls. These are teenagers that they're attacking. And it just speaks to how women are dehumanized and how women of color in hijab are dehumanized and just women of color are dehumanized to be like punching bags for violent men. And it's just, that's the part that really gets to me. I think people have been referring to that as gendered Islamophobia, just like how Islamophobia affects women in a very violent way, unlike the way it affects men. Something that I've been reflecting a lot on is just like, yeah, there's Islamophobia in this world, but how it affects women is completely different than how it affects a man who's walking about day to day.
It reminds me, I had a professor when I was back at Cal who said, where men suffer, women die.
Yeah. Do you know what game I've been playing? Is every time I watch the news, I go, what would this look like without misogyny? Just to put that male twist on it, and everything that's happening in the news that's violent is being driven by a man. And if you take out the misogyny, patriarchy, male component, then there would be no violence. It's a fun game to play. It's a really depressing game to play.
Yeah, it speaks to, I mean, before we get super professorial, I mean, that is Orientalism, right? A feminization of a culture, of a people, and then using that for what are basically acts of misogyny also. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm butchering intersectional feminism right now. Like, I'm just thinking about the attack in Kansas on the two young men who they thought were Iranians. And then how, like, my brain leapt to how much we lauded the white man who, you know, protected everybody else and put himself, his body in the way, and then just kind of moved on.
Yeah, I mean, that happened in the Portland stabbing, too. It was the three white men that were murdered. Well, two of them were murdered. One of them survived. But it was the lauding of those white men. I mean, they, like, died for these people. So I'm not trying to put it down.
No, of course not.
But the news was reflecting that. And when it came to NetBros attack, you heard a lot of people saying, why didn't the rest of the girls that were in the group stop to save her? And it's just like, well, they were running for their lives. Like, you can't put the blame on the group of girls. You know, when you're running for your life, you're running for your life. And that was like really sad to see, too. This idea that because she tripped and she fell behind, that it was the fault of the group.
You know what else I saw in the Washington Post? There was this whole conversation about how NetBros was really into fashion, unlike the rest of the girls. Ugh. And I was like, what a bizarre sentence to put in there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they're trying to like make her seem American, right? Like this.
It sounded more like they were trying to say, well, you know, part of it was that like she wasn't as into prayer and it was one of her few times going to Qiyam or I don't know what that term is. I'm not familiar with it, but.
Oh, that's terrible.
It was awful. It was a Washington Post article that was just, you know, quoting people's descriptions of her. And I just was like waiting to see how that was going to unfold. And I was really glad that I didn't see any more of it.
Yeah.
That's going to sit with me for a really long time.
We know that a lot of you are grieving out there and have a lot of feelings about this. And we are there with you. We are sitting with it, too.
there's all this like cause for celebration, Taz, about Muslims being represented more in mainstream television and film.
Blech.
I was gonna say, and you have some opinions on this.
Blech. So, I mean, we are very excited to know that Hasan Minhaj's Homecoming King is out on Netflix. Loved it. It was amazing. I was also loving Aziz Ansari in Master of None. I was kind of loving Night Of with Riz Ahmed.
And I hated it. But say more.
I didn't get past episode one, which probably means I didn't love it. And then I just watched The Big Sick, which is Kumail Nanjiani's new romantic comedy. And I kind of maxed out after that. I watched that 2 weeks ago. It's out in theaters next week. And, you know, I'm like over Muslim men telling me how I should see the brown narrative. It was a lot of brown male narrative that was happening in all of that. And I was just like, ugh.
It's also a lot of brown male narrative framed around a white woman, right?
Oh my gosh. Why does everyone need a white woman to like tell their story?
Okay, but then does this mean that when I tell my Netflix story, like when I'm on Netflix and I have my pilot finally, and I have my infidel husband, my white man, I'm going to have to like have Muslim brown men because they never did it for us. Is that what I'm supposed to do now?
No, but I think what is happening is that the use of white women in all these narratives, even in Hasan's story, his prom date ended up not wanting to go to prom with him. So he kind of like frames his story around this white woman, even though he talks about his sister and his wife and his family. And I think what happened in The Big Sick is that Kumail Nanjiani's character, he meets this white girl at a comedy show. Her name's Emily, and they fall in love, and then they break up, and then she gets sick, which isn't a spoiler alert considering the title of the movie. It's called The Big Sick. And the second half of the movie revolves more around his relationship with her parents. And even in Aziz Ansari's series, both season one and season two had a white girl that they were framing it around. Anyways, all this to say is that I think that these white girls that they are chasing in these movies also serves to make brown men of color palatable to white people in this kind of like default kind of way. Like, what would it mean to have a story where you don't have any white people in it, like Crazy Rich Asian, which is superficial. But one of the interesting things about that novel is that it's a whole entire narrative where there are no white people. It's kind of cool.
Or Moonlight, which also was not at all framed around white people, which won an Academy Award.
Yeah.
It can happen. There are two things that annoy me about this whole phenomenon is that, like, number one is the inability to critique anything about it. People always clench up like, oh, we should celebrate it. We've got to celebrate it. Like,
yeah.
Chill out. All right. Chill out. White people also get to critique other white people's films. I think we'll all survive.
Yes.
Then the second thing that drives me nuts is this, and I haven't seen Homecoming yet. I haven't seen The Big Sick yet, so I can't really speak to that. But I just know that there's this like expectation that if we don't, and this is what my New York Times piece was about, is that there's this expectation that if we don't try to bring in relatable elements or elements that some TV executive or some writer perceives to be relatable, then it's not going to happen. People will not relate. It will alienate audiences.
Well, the thing that I saw in an interview for The Big Sick is that Kumail didn't want to have his Muslimness come up in his film. He didn't write a piece on it. And then Judd Apatow, who produced the film, kept asking Kumail to include that. So because of that, there's a scene in The Big Sick where he goes down to the basement to pray, but he's actually playing video games and his parents think he's praying. And it kind of comes to an end where his parents and him have a confrontation and he says, I'm not praying because I don't know if I believe in that. And in other situations, I would think like, oh, this is like an honest representation. But at the same time, it's kind of like, why do all these Muslim men who decide they're not Muslim anymore have to have this I'm not that Muslim narrative in it? Like, I would have preferred if Kumail just didn't have that scene in his movie at all. Like, there shouldn't be this pressure for brown men or brown people to be extra noting their Muslimness in their films. Like, I think Aziz Ansari in all of season one didn't really address his Muslimness. And I think that was kind of cool that, like, we don't need to have this.
Well, and then there was the bacon episode.
Yeah, the bacon episode in season two, where I feel like was also kind of like playing to white America, saying like, hey, I'm just like you. I'm not that Muslim. I don't know. I'm over it.
I feel sad that Judd Apatow, like, kind of...
I know.
That sounds to me like he sort of forced it on him.
Yeah.
And Mr. Apatow, if you're listening, I'm happy to work with you. separately, I would like to say, ew. Like, because I get that all the time.
Yeah.
I get that all the time in my writing. Like, when I have white editors in on my writing, there's always the, like, oh, yeah, and share the bad Muslim component.
Yeah.
And, of course, like, when people ask us about our show, good Muslim, bad Muslim, who's the bad one? Who's the bad one? Who's... And it's like, no, actually, it's about how you polarize a people so that you stop seeing them as three-dimensional people.
Yeah. And, you know, I love all Apatow films because I love rom-coms. And what was actually great about The Big Sick was after the manic pixie girl is in a coma, after she's gone from the movie, but basically, Kumail has this amazing narrative around her parents, who are played by Holly Hunter and Ray Romano. And it's just like the scripting, the scenes, they're just like really beautiful and tender. And they have nothing to do with race or, you know, Muslimness. It's just a very great piece. And it was very Apatow.
Okay, but that's really morbid. It's morbid that in both The Night Of and in The Big Sick, this brown man was able to explore his life for good or for bad after the death of a white woman.
Yeah.
That's a little morbid.
She didn't die.
Oh, she just got sick.
Yeah, she's sick. Big Sick.
Maybe I should watch the movie.
But like for The Big Sick, like all the brown characters in it were just caricatures. It was like the only like real buildup of portrayal of people was in white people. And like when it came to brown people, like it's like, oh, we just have to play stereotypes here. They're just going to be the like comedic punching bag. And it was like, why can't you, like, you did it with Holly Hunter. You could have done the same thing with these other actors. You don't need to, like, make brown people punching bags and white people the, like, well-written, well-developed characters. It was so annoying. Over it.
Over it.
Over it.
Over it.
And then, you know what I was really upset by? Is that when I went on my Twitter rant after I saw The Big Sick, one of the responses on Twitter was that, oh, it's because these Muslim men are writing stories. Where are the Muslim women writing stories? I'm fucking writing stories all the time. Turn my shit into a TV show. Turn Zara into a TV show. Like, we're out here. Muslim women are writing our stories. It's just the men are the ones getting picked up by mainstream Netflix and studios. And, you know, they're just not picking up Muslim women narrative because we're not as palatable as these men dating white women are. Boom. I said it.
I'm right here. I'm right here.
You're here.
And you're here.
Just because we're not going to make it palatable for your whiteness.
Hold up, Taz. To be fair, though. If only you had a long-running column about romance and dating.
I know.
Then maybe, because, like, I don't think you've ever written your story about dating. I don't think you've ever talked about that, Tez. I don't think you have any writing on that.
It's not like any of it was funny or anything, right? I could do a whole TV series around my hot doctor.
Yeah, actually, that is a whole series. Your hot doctor, your ex who could have been an FBI informant.
Yes. That's my rom-com, by the way. I'm working that script. Come at me, Hollywood.
Give it to us, Apatow.
Come at me.
And again, Mr. Apatow, if you would like to tokenize me or my family for a high-paying Netflix flick, I may not say no.
Zara and I would be great bridesmaid in a movie. Like in Bridesmaid 2? Did that already happen?
Oh my God, we'd be amazing.
In Bridesmaid 3? Like, what if we make Bridesmaid 3 like the Muslim bridesmaid? And then, like, it's like, hey, we are bridesmaids, but we go to Dubai. And chaos happens. It'd be so much fun. It'd be like when Sex and the City went to Dubai, but it'd be like Taz and Zara go to Dubai. So it would be a little bit more chaotic and less glamorous, but it would be so fun. That's our pitch.
You know, Paul Feig retweeted me once. Maybe I could start the conversation.
Yeah, do it. Over it.
Over it.
Over it. So over it. Over Muslim men telling their narratives. Over it.
Let's do Creeping Sharia.
If I ever had a rom-com, my lead actor would be Mahershala Ali.
He's going to be in my rom-com.
No, he's in my rom-com. I have the GQ cover magazine underneath my pillow, and it's on my vision board, and I'm making it a thing.
I have the GQ cover on my homepage, on my phone, and I sit on it 3 times a day.
That doesn't sound very Ramadan-like.
Young lady, that's not very Ramadan-like.
For people that don't know, Mahershala Ali is on the cover of GQ and he is looking good.
Oh my God, it's so hot.
He is giving me some un-Ramadan-like thoughts when I look at it. Did you watch the video of it too, Zara?
There's a video?
Go to GQ.com. There's a video of them doing the photograph. So he's just like standing there looking really hot. And then the picture with him holding the puppy, OMG. It's like, can this get any cuter? It's like a hot man and then you put a really cute hot puppy with him. Come on. Ridiculous. Why would you do that to us?
Oh my God. He's so beautiful.
He's so beautiful. He's on the cover of GQ. So Creeping Sharia, for people that don't know, Mahershala Ali is Muslim.
And Muslims are on the cover of GQ. Bam.
And everyone's drooling over him, which means that Muslims are worth drooling over. Hint, hint.
I want to be on the cover of GQ one day.
I don't think women are on the cover of GQ.
I want to trailblaze.
Trailblaze?
I want to trailblaze and be on the cover of GQ. I'm going to set that as a goal so that if I don't meet it, I feel like a failure.
Don't do that. Like, put yourself on the cover of Cosmo or something. Teen Vogue.
Teen Vogue. Ooh. Would you do a Vogue cover if they asked you?
Yes. Hell yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Even if they were like, we want to, like, give you a bindi and then cover you in henna and then put you in this, like, vaguely oriental garb. Like, they would probably give you a bindi and then put you in a kimono and then be like, Taz Ahmed.
On a flying carpet.
In a mosque.
In a mosque. Like, let's just super orientalize this.
Let's just go all out.
Yes, I would do it. Totally. Because I am a sellout to the ninth degree. I need to make money, girl. I need to figure out if I can make money off of that, I'd do it. Done.
We are women in our 30s. We don't have time to follow through on our opinions.
Nope. All that stuff's going out the window. I need to make money. Unless people give me money. Speaking of giving money, it is Ramadan. It is a time of giving. Give us zakat. You can donate on our website. Anyways.
That's right. You guys should be zakating it up right now.
Totally zakating up.
And then maybe Zara will not have a blue mic anymore.
Zakat it up. Donate to us so we don't have to sell out and be in the cover of Vogue. Even if I got your zakat, though, I probably would be on the cover of Vogue. Because it's Vogue.
It's Vogue.
Not like that's even an option. We're just pretending right now.
I'm not pretending. I don't know that I would do it. I'm just going to say that. I'm actually secretly just hoping that my coyness makes them want me more. All right, let's fatwa. Okay, I have a positive fatwa. I would like us to entertain the notion that Rumi, the world's most famous poet, might have loved the D.
The D.
Maybe he loved dick.
I think he did. I think that's very clear in his poetry.
It's Pride Month. Yay, Pride!
Yay!
Happy Pride Month. Happy anniversary of me coming out. I mean, technically that'll be July, but hey, Pride Month. All right, here's the thing. It's interesting to me that the New Yorker magazine wrote this great article about how there's been the erasure of Islam from Rumi ever since the Victorian era, actually.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that Rumi was listened to by Victorian era white people. I thought Rumi was just a thing that people in our region of the world listened to.
No, Rumi is the most famous, most read poet in the world, more than Shakespeare.
I had no idea.
Yes, he's Persian. And there's all these people who are Afghani who are like, Persian Empire, Persian. Yeah, I'm going to take it. Okay, here's what I really want to get at. Rumi has this relationship with Shams that everyone is always like, well, they're really good friends. And it's not like, you know, it's not like love. It's like ecstatic love. And like Persian men, they kiss each other on the cheek all the time and it's no thing. And it borders homophobic for me. If it's no thing, then why are you so uncomfortable?
Yeah.
Kiss each other on the cheek, suck each other's dicks. Be good friends.
That's what good friends do.
That's what I'm saying. If it's not homophobic, then why do you get so testy when somebody suggests that maybe they were into it?
Yeah, there is a lot of like, for Rumi, they do say that like, oh, he's just in love with God and this is an allegory and symbolism.
And maybe every now and then he just like made it literal.
Yeah, what if it was actual factual?
So what?
It would still be good poetry.
Exactly.
So I'm not sure I understand what your fatwa is.
My positive fatwa is that we all just decide to agree that Rumi is hella gay.
Oh yeah, totally, done. I've been deciding that.
We can love his super gayness.
Yeah.
And then explore maybe his bisexuality. As a bisexual woman, I'm into that. But like, quit with the homophobic, him and Shams were just friends crap.
Done. My fatwa is against uncles that super mansplain.
Explain some more, Tez.
Well, I was in Charlotte a month ago for the Defined America Festival. Jose Antonio Vargas invited me, And I moderated a panel for the movie Meet the Patels, which is a film where Ravi Patel goes on a series of rishtas and setup dates and conferences so that he can find the right Patel wife. So anyways, at this film festival, I was moderating the panel with some awesome people and Ravi's parents. Ravi's parents were there, who turn into being big parts in the movie. So then I think I did a really good job of facilitating the panel. I think I'm a good panel facilitator. And I have a lot to say about being single and about being brown and about looking for love. So I had a great Q&A session. Before the Q&A, I got into a conversation with Ravi's dad, actually, about the podcast. And he was like, oh, good Muslim, bad Muslim. We need to hear more from good Muslims. Where are all the good Muslims? I was like, we're there. We're making media. He's like, but you don't hear about it in the media.
Ugh, biggest eye roll in the universe.
We're making the media. You're just not listening. So as a moderator of the panel, I was able to ask a question to a Muslim person on the panel and be like, hey, where are all the Muslims making media? And she answered, we're out there. We're making great stuff. So I was glad that I was able to smash that in my facilitation. And then someone in the audience, after my questions were done, asked the question, so what about people who are older and single and they can't find someone to get married to? And then the dad answered that you need to marry someone young. You need to marry in your 20s. And if you're 40 and you're unmarried, then it's absolutely hopeless and you're out of luck. And then I responded, I followed up because I think that's a terrible thing to say. Also, I'm 38. I'm turning 38 next month. And I think it's really important that we have an alternative narrative out there. So I said, well, I'm in my late 30s and I'm single. And I think sometimes love just isn't in the cards for you to find a partner, and you just have to find other ways to find love, and you have to make your life fulfilling, and you have to be passionate, and you have to, you know, make your life full, and if it happens, then it happens. And then do you know what this uncle said? He interrupted me and said, well, I just want to say, I know, he like interrupted me and said, well, I just want to say that women who are older and single are just too superficial, and they just look at aesthetics, and they're not actually giving the guys a chance, and they're just spend too much time just focusing on looks. And do you know what I said? I said, next question. Because I was moderating the panel, and I was like, in my head, I was like, what would Jose Antonio Vargas do in this moment? And then I got really upset.
What I was going to ask is he dead now?
He's not dead. But I was not nice to him after the panel was over. I was courteous. But I was like,
The man who played the uncle uncled you.
Ugh. What's ridiculous is that his daughter is older than me. Like, he has a single daughter who's older than me. Someone was like saying that, oh, he's just projecting his daughter. I was like, I don't care. Like, I'm there. You don't say that to the person moderating the panel. Like, it's rude. Like, people are watching this. Like, that's so disrespectful.
There's so much sexism in that response.
So much.
That, like, my head can't even wrap around it. Like, A, that he's, like, taking up time and interrupting you to, like, talk about how superficial he perceives his daughter to be. And then also that, like, there's this, like, that anyone would even consider to mention that older women are superficial in the men they seek. Have you seen the women that older men date?
I know. That's what I was thinking, too.
Hello.
Exactly.
The, like, number of 19 and 20-year-olds that would come in with older men at the lingerie shop that I used to work at.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in my 20s, I used to work at a lingerie shop. What the fuck?
I know.
Superficial?
If anything, like, I feel like men are the superficial ones, not women. Like, every hot woman that I know that is dating someone is definitely dating a man that is, like, not to their level of hotness. You know, like, the hot women are definitely going below. That's not even the point, though. You know what I mean? Like, that's, like, it's, like, now we're stuck on this conversation about superficiality when, like, that's not even what love is about, you know? Like,
I just think it's funny that, like, in the course of this podcast, like, you've had accusations thrust at you that you don't write enough and that you don't, as an activist, think enough about the substance of men instead of their looks.
I know.
Was he just telling you to, like, date his ugly son? Maybe that was what it was.
No, I was too old for his ugly son, right?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Over it.
Over it.
Over it. Okay, so we're moving into awkward ask a Muslim, but does it get even more awkward than that, Taz?
It does. Let's go with your story first.
Oh, God. I keep getting the whole, like, because I do comedy. I tour a lot. every time I go on tour, like I've been doing a lot, right? I had the New York Times piece. I had the Fresh Air piece. It's been a really exciting year for me. And people will say, well, if it wasn't for Trump, your career. And I'm like, are you kidding me?
What, they're implying that you wouldn't have a career if it wasn't for Trump?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yes, that's what they're saying. They're saying you wouldn't have a New York Times piece. You wouldn't have a Fresh Air piece if it wasn't for Trump.
Oh, that's so dismissive.
And disgusting.
Also, like, Kumail Nanjiani's film, Hasan Minhaj, Aziz Ansari, all that was in pre-production when Trump got elected. You know, like, all these Muslim people who are getting platforms were getting platforms before the election happened. That's terrible.
Yep. And also, if it wasn't for Trump, actually, I wouldn't be afraid to have a calendar on my website about my tour dates. And if it wasn't for Trump, I would have more frequent shows because I wouldn't be terrified. And if it wasn't for Trump, I would have said yes to all of the invitations to Texas that I said no to.
Yeah, totally.
So no, actually, like it has significantly damaged a career of mine that probably would have skyrocketed if it wasn't that also I'm terrified. Thanks.
Yeah. Especially like the added component of being like a Muslim woman and the fear that, back to gendered Islamophobia, like how we hold a certain kind of fear that maybe Aziz Ansari doesn't have to deal with.
Yeah.
Also, he's like loaded with money and is probably has security and stuff. But still, you get what I'm trying to say.
I do.
My awkward ask a Muslim has to do with fasting. I went to a wedding of our friend Atsuko. She got married and it was a super fun wedding.
Congratulations, Atsuko!
Congrats.
Yay!
And she had a buffet, a Chinese buffet, and they served it at like 6 p.m. And in LA, you don't break fast until 8 p.m.
Ooh.
So I was like sitting at this table and the person that was sitting across from me, she was really sweet. She was like, oh my gosh, I'm so hungry. And I was like, and I didn't say anything. She's like, oh, but you're fasting. I'm so sorry. I was like, no, it's totally fine. And she's like, I don't think I can eat if you're sitting in front of me. I was like, no, it's okay. Like, this is part of Ramadan. She's like, oh, but I'm so hungry. But then you're eating and I won't be able to eat if you're sitting in front of me. I was like, I'm just gonna go on a walk when it's time to eat. And so then I like took a seat outside while people were eating. I was like, this is so awkward that I had to like, because I don't mind if people are eating around me during Ramadan. Like, it's a wedding. Like, I would rather socialize instead of like not socialize. But instead I had to like put myself into like the corner while people were eating. And like people would come out one at a time to talk to me. It was so weird. It was so awkward.
Is that why you were texting me asking me about when Shia's breakfast?
No.
You were like trying to like Shia breakfast, like hoping that it's earlier when it's actually later.
Shia's breakfast later. I don't want to breakfast on Shia time. Are you kidding me? It's like half an hour after I breakfast.
Shia time. So when it was time to finally breakfast at the wedding, did you just like make a beeline for the cake?
Well, I was nervous that there wouldn't be any food. So D'Lo and his partner like made me a plate and set it aside. So it was really sweet.
Aww.
Everyone was really lovely. All of our friends were there. It was great. I just think it was funny that this is the first time I've ever been at an event where I had to like time out myself because I was making the people around me uncomfortable with my fasting. I was like, this is so weird.
This is an awkward thing with women always. I hate it when other women will like push food on my plate because like they won't eat it. Or if they're like, you're not eating, I want you to eat with me. Yeah, and then like shopping too. Like I would go shopping with my friends and it's always like, I want you to buy something now. And I'm like, no, I can't. Okay. Because I gained 30 pounds of Trump weight and I can't right now. I can't shop at Forever 21 with you right now. I can't. Okay.
I can't spend money. Mine was more like spending money because I've been spent so much of my life broke that it was like all my friends would spend like egregious amount of money shopping. And then I'd be like, I'm going to buy this keychain. You know, like I just couldn't afford a lot of stuff when I was out. But like I wanted to hang out.
All right. It's time for some good Muslim awards.
Speaking of shopping, I want to give my good Muslim award to, I could never figure out how to say this, O'Reilly. It is a really well-known nail polish brand.
Orly.
It's not O'Reilly.
Oh, really? I always thought it was like what your favorite sex position is. Orly.
Orally. Anyway, now this sounds really haram, but they partnered with Muslim Girl to create halal nail polish. So the halal nail polish has been around for a couple of years. I think we've talked about it. These are like they're breathable nail polish. So when you wash yourself for prayer, when you do wudu, the water will go through your nails and it's considered halal nail polish. But what's new is that Muslim Girl partnered with them to create a line of nail polish, which is actually pretty expensive. And they're called halal paint. And some of the names that are in it are Harambe and What is the Fatima.
Oh, that's awesome.
And Ignore the Hates. So they make all these like Muslim puns, which they're cute. And Amani from Muslim Girl was one of the persons that helped them name it. So she named one after herself. And then hers is called the Perfect Amani Cure.
Oh, that's adorable.
Manicure. Oh, I get it. I had to say it out loud to get it, but I get it now.
That's awesome.
Zara, do you want some nail polish for Eid?
I do. I'm really over the gel.
Really?
I'm really over it.
Now you're all into the halal nail polish, maybe?
I'm totally into it. Yeah. Also, my grandma would be really happy.
Oh.
My grandma used to make us, like, if I had a little bit of nail polish on the corner of my thumbnail, she would say, you have to do all your prayers again and 60 times over.
And would you?
Well, I mean, you know. What is prayer? Is it daydreaming while you go bobbing up and down? 60 times? I was in Iran when I was like 14, 13 years old. And I like, we had a wedding for my cousin that we'd gone to, and I like painted my nails. And then afterward, I like rubbed them with alcohol, right, to do my prayers. And then my grandma like already knew. She like already knew what she was doing.
She knew, man. She knew.
And she was like, oh, just like I thought, 60 times over.
Well, now you have something to buy her.
I'm going to buy her some halal.
I feel like your grandmother, even if you bought her this, she'd be like, no, it doesn't count.
Probably.
What's your Good Muslim Award for?
My Good Muslim Award is to the Muslim Alliance for Sexual and Gender Diversity, Masjid.
Masjid. We have some great friends over there, Faisal and Uruj and a bunch of other folks.
They've been organizing and advocating for LGBTQ Muslims since 1997.
Yeah, and they do this annual conference every year. So if we have any queer Muslims listening, there is actually a conference for you.
Yeah, it's pretty rad. Go to MuslimAlliance.org and check them out.
They've been doing a lot of organizing since the Pulse shooting. So it's been great to see the activity that's been coming out of that space, which is a year ago. The Pulse shooting happened during Ramadan last year, so it's been a year.
Maybe that's why I've just, like, this Ramadan has been hard.
It's been so hard. Physically, it's been a little bit easier for me this year because I think the fact that I did Whole 30 before I started Ramadan, like my body was prepared, but I don't think I was like spiritually prepared for this Ramadan. I'm kind of sad to see it go. Today's the last day of Ramadan.
That's a really good way of putting it, that you weren't spiritual. That's how I feel, like, because I remember yesterday when we were talking about our agenda for today, like I was really in a funk and just like not well. And you kept asking me, like, what's going on? And I kept having to search for it. And it was like, oh, maybe it's because there was the brutal beating of a lovely young girl named Nabra Hassanin. Maybe it's because of Philando Castile's, like, total lack of justice, or another person who got shot and stabbed, or another person who got shot and stabbed. Or is it because it's in memory of the Pulse shooting that was just a year ago? Or because at this time last year, I was filled with bugs because I was, like, coming out to my parents for the first time? Or is it because, I mean, my God.
There's a lot.
It's been a hard month.
It's been a hard month. I think one of the things that I've been reflecting on this month, though, is that we need to find joy. Because if we are just feeling the weight of the world on us, and there's always going to be violence, there's always going to be terrible things that makes us feel like we've lost agency. But we need to find joy despite all of that. And I think that is part of what godliness is to me, I guess. Like, is the, like, making sure that all these things are just, like, obstructions, and that despite all of that, we need to figure out how do we find joy in that. And I think this is also because I was at Allied Media Conference, and that space was just so full of love despite everything. And I know that in a lot of the Black Lives Matter spaces, they've been talking about Black joy and Black girl magic. And I think I kind of need to find that equivalent of being brown and being Muslim. Is like, where is my joy? I mean, that was kind of the theme of my Ramadan, is like trying to figure out, like, well, terrible things are going to be happening constantly. So how do we find joy despite that? And how do we use that joy as our life force to keep going? Which is a struggle. It's not easy.
Well said.
Hopefully I will leave this Ramadan prepared to attack the world with joy and love, figuring out how to fight all the negativity with positivity. Oh my gosh, I sound so Californian. On that note.
I want to say, this Ramadan, I'm closing out in memory of Nabra Hassanan and Charlena Lyles.
And the unnamed women from the Portland attacks, who are unnamed because they didn't want their names out in the media, which is also sad.
And yeah, understandable.
Zara, what's coming up for this next month for you?
I'm doing a series of pop-ups in San Francisco. I'm going to do some pop-up shows.
What?
not pop-up the magazine pop-up, but a Zara Norbeck's pop-up of my comedy show On Behalf of All Muslims.
Awesome.
I'm looking to take it to New York. If you're a theater space or a comedy space in New York that would like to talk to me about how to do that on behalf of all Muslims, I would like to bring it there.
I will be hopefully spending more time writing this month. We can spend some summer days writing. But I will be at the Smithsonian APA Lit Festival the weekend of July 8th. I'm really excited. I'll be doing some poetry. I'll be doing some literoki, which is literary karaoke. Super excited to be there. So if you're in D.C., come out for that. If you're even close to D.C., come out for that. That's going to be an amazing time. There's so many fantastic Asian American writers that will be coming out for that. Zara, Eid Mubarak!
Eid Mubarak! Eid Mubarak! Eid Mubarak! And happy Pride!
And happy Pride.
Thanks for listening to the Good Muslim, Bad Muslim podcast, hosted by Taz Ahmed and Zara Norbash. You can follow Taz on Twitter at TazzyStar. That's TazzyStar. And Zara at Zara Comedy. That's ZAHRA Comedy. The show is produced and edited by Quincy Sarasmith, and you can find us on the web at goodmuslimbadmuslim.com. To follow the conversation, please use the hashtag GoodMuslimBadMuslim. Good Muslim, Bad Muslim is a proud member of Potluck, a collective that features stories and voices from the Asian American community.
Holy Potluck. Over it.
Over it.
Over it.
Over it.